Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Hope you're staying safe, hope you're staying sane, hope you're staying healthy, hope you're staying good to one another. We got through another week, and at the time of this recording, maybe an election result, who knows. But anyway, hope you're doing okay. Hope you've been able to distract yourself with some movies. And a little later on, I'm going to get to what I watched a little later on, but it will involve my special guest when we get to that. But I'm gonna save that for later. How's that for suspense? I wound up seeing more films than I thought I would, even though I, full disclosure, was working the polls during the election. But there's a new film, and there's a Soucy family tradition that I want to start with for this week's program. A new film from IFC Midnight called Kindred, and it's a story of a pregnant woman with her boyfriend, and they go to visit his family to not only let them know that she, well, they're letting the mother, who's got an iron grip on everything, know that they're going to be moving to Australia. Then we find out that the girlfriend is pregnant. There's a turn of events. The boyfriend, the father of the child to be, is killed in an accident, and the pregnant girl is now stuck at the house of his mother and his brother. Even though it's not his brother, they keep having a running bit with this story. This is one of these trapped in the house stories. There's a number of them, but ones that come to mind for me is You'll Like My Mother, with if you remember from 1972, with Patty Duke and Richard Thomas, Rosemary Murphy. This was a rare villainous role for Richard Thomas at that time. Misery is another one with, of course, Kathy Bates and James Caan. And there's a number of them where folks are stuck in a house. And in this case, she is stuck. The woman is stuck against her will. And a bit of gaslighting from the brother in this household. But what caught my eye with this film is the fact that unknown to me actors, except for one, and it's Fiona Shaw, who plays the mother. I've loved Fiona Shaw's work ever since My Left Foot, and I know she did a production of Madea, which I would love to get my hands on someday to watch, but she's always fascinating, even if the material is not. And this film, it's okay. It's from IFC Midnight, so it's a thriller, and you kind of know by the numbers what's going to happen when. And when we get to about an hour five, when the pregnant woman makes an escape attempt, that it makes the obvious dumb cinematic choices, and it kind of took me out of it. But I was really coming for this to see Fiona Shaw's performance, and it is mostly understated. She walks with a cane, but has a huge grip on the household and her family, and in this case, this young pregnant woman, and mostly understated. I was intrigued to see how far, if she would go over the top. And there's a couple heightened moments, but it didn't go over the top. But it was still fun to watch Fiona Shaw. I was reminded of the performance from Isabelle Huppert from the Neil Jordan thriller Greta, with and I remember saying as I watched it, that Isabelle Huppert chews scenery with a knife and fork. And I was wondering if Fiona Shaw was going to go that way. Not quite, but it's still an understated performance. And I think the main reason to watch the film is for her. And if you enjoy Trapped in the House movies, Prisoner Against Your in a Household film. So not my cup of tea, but definitely go there for Fiona Shaw. So we have a tradition here at the household, at the Soucy household, and I have to give credit to my daughter Emma, who, by the way, turned 19 on Thursday. So happy birthday, sweetheart. Happy birthday from your old dad, who's just getting older. But I had worked the elections in my town where I was actually a floater, and it was a very, very long day, up at 4, at the polling place at 5. We didn't get out till after 8 o'clock because of a technical glitch. So I didn't get home till about 9. And Emma was one that we took to the polls every time, no matter how early it was or how cold or what have you. But we waited in line, and then you bribe a child with breakfast. And this was the first time Emma got to vote. And so it was for a dad to go to the polls with her, and then we go have breakfast. It was a great dad-daughter moment. But we, on election night, always watch the film Election. And this was her idea. I think she was probably 12 when we first watched it with her, because she liked Matthew Broderick and sort of knew about Reese Witherspoon. And as she's getting older and more world aware, likes the film even more. And it still holds up as far as politics and high school, and sometimes they're just one in the same. So anyway, got to watch both something old and something new, and have a family tradition. So, and it kept us from looking at the poll the election results on that Tuesday night. So, all right. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Let's go around and see what physical activities and virtual screenings you can check out over at the Tibbs Drive-In this weekend. Yes, drive-ins in November. We are the Midwest. At the Tibbs Drive-In, on screen one, you have Grease and Dirty Dancing. On screen two, Friday and Bridesmaids, which I always have to remind, and I was reminded, this was the second R-rated movie my daughter got to watch. The first one was Enter the Dragon, which has my thumbprints all over it. So, screen three, Monty Python and the Holy Grail and the Naked Gun. And then a private event at screen four. That's over at the Tibbs Drive-In. Over at the Skyline in Shelbyville, we have Mars Attacks. Wow. And The Campaign, of course. It's funny. I'm currently in rehearsal for the 1940s radio version of It's a Wonderful Life, which is going to be happening at Richmond Civic in December. And we were actually discussing Mars Attacks. One of my cohorts, Kate, remember saying she was disappointed the first time she watched it because it was a lot of big names. And it was kind of silly. And I liked it more than she did initially, especially when it came out in 96, because I knew, well, just me, now I'm being terrible, Tim Burton made a very expensive C movie and had big name stars involved in it. So I need to revisit that. And I said to give it another watch, especially if you weren't ready for it or just didn't quite know the tone. In 1996, she's going to hit me the next time she sees me, I know. Anyway, Mars Attacks and The Campaign over at the Skyline. Over at the Can-Can Cinema on Monday, November 9th, our National Family Album, a webinar as part of the Spirit and Place Festival. You have to register, so go to Can-Can, that's with a K, cancanindie.com/upcoming events. Over at the Art Craft Theater in Franklin, you have The Bridge on the River Kwai on Saturday, November 7th at 2 and 7:30 p.m. and 2 p.m. on Sunday, November 8th. November 13th is the Real Women Vintage Wine Event on November 13th, Friday at 7:30 p.m., Moulin Rouge. And then November 14th at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m., Cartoons for Cans. Admission is canned good, non-perishable, donated. This goes to the Interchurch Food Pantry. And then November 14th, a Brew and View event, Saturday night, November 14th at 7:30 p.m., Roadhouse. All right. And then November 20th and 21st at 2 and 7:30 p.m. And then Sunday, November 22nd at 2 and 5:30 p.m. at the Art Craft Theater in Franklin, The Bells of St. Mary. Over at IU Cinema, as far as virtual events, running through November 11th is the 2018 documentary Maroney for President. Through November 18th, Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President. Through November 11th, Nation Time, the 1972 documentary. Through November 18th, Radium Girls from 2018. Tuesday, November 10th, a special virtual event of the documentary The Painter and the Thief. Friday, November 13th, coming up through Wednesday, December 2nd, the 2020 documentary City Hall. And then Friday, November 13th, special virtual event at 7 p.m., the 2020 documentary IU 2020 Part 1. All of that is happening at IU Cinema. Okay, grab a pencil, and let's go through what you have been watching. And we start, as always, via email from my buddy Eric, who starts with The Booksellers, which he deemed as a good plus. Probably as far as rewatching, The Raven from 1963, good. The good-natured comic fantasy riffing of Edgar Allan Poe. Shadow of a Doubt from 1943, a great Hitchcock classic. And 1944's Lifeboat, outstanding Hitchcockery, says Eric. So thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Over at, we go on to Twitter, and we start with Eric, who says The Horror of Dracula and The Way, Way Back with Sam Rockwell. Hi, Ann Leaker. And it was funny. Something came up on my Twitter page. I have to give credit to at Super 70s Sports. And it was a graphic of, if you remember, for some of us, of the early incarnations of HBO. And when they would screen an R-rated movie, they'd have the rating, and then parents may wish to consider whether it should be viewed by children under 17. HBO will show this feature only at night. And I remember, and the Twitter post from Super 70 at Super 70 Sports is the quote, "Your dad and I are leaving for dinner now." And then 2 seconds later, you're watching R-rated movies on HBO. So, and yeah, Steve says, "I remember that graphic. Wow, it takes me back." And my friend Eric is like, "Oh, turn it out. Wait, here comes Mom and Dad. Turn off the hitchhiker." So I'm paraphrasing. But anyway, so good memory there. That was fun. All right, going to Facebook. We start with Moveen, who says, "Cane River," directed by Horace B. Jenkins. Mason writes, "Borat Part 2." That's not what it's called, but that's what we were told not to call it Borat Part 2 in our press release. So, yes, subsequent movie film. Darren writes, "Mad Love, The Four Skulls of Jonathan Drake, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the Frederick March version, House of Wax, and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Adam Crow, hey Adam. The Fog, the original, of course." Dave writes, "I might have listed this one last week, but I was compelled to watch it again. Get Out, a really suspenseful movie, well worth a watch." Joe Ellen writes, "The Queen's Gambit." Catherine writes, "Ocean's 13, The Craft, and Star Wars, A New Hope." Sam writes, Sam Watermeyer, "Revisited Ransom, one of Ron Howard's best. When I was a kid, I thought it was the edgiest thing I'd ever seen. Of course, I've seen far edgier films since, but it holds up. Fun fact, Smashing Pumpkins' Billy Corgan contributed music that set the mood for the kidnapper's lair." Roxana writes, "The new version of The Witches with Anne, Octavia, and Chris Rock." Kayla writes, "The first four Nightmare on Elm Streets." Yes, really. Jared writes, "Field of Dreams." Darlene writes, "Judy." Dustin writes, "One Royal Holiday" from 2020. Kate writes, my buddy Kate, "No One Sleeps in the Woods Tonight," "Cadaver," and "His House." Doug writes, "Gone with the Wind." Martin writes, "Midsummer was our Halloween scary movie of choice. Finally saw the Amazon Prime miniseries Good Omens, based upon one of my favorite books." Sean writes, "On the Rocks." Jessica writes, "Shudder movies before we cancel. Daniel is Real, Monster Party, and Mayhem. All were better than I expected." Christian writes, "From Russia with Love." and it adds, and I feel so complicated about Bond, so problematic. This is one of my favorites, but it is a pretty homophobic portrayal of the evil agent and the usual misogyny, of course. We'll be getting into Sean Connery a little later on in the show. Also not a film, but I started watching a Turkish Netflix series called The Protector. It is set in Istanbul, like From Russia with Love. I think a trip to Istanbul might be in my future someday. Christian, and I hope you get it. I hope we all get the travel. Daniel writes, election 2020, haha. Mark writes, introduced a new group of theater students to sneakers. Be a beacon. All right, Mark, this is my buddy Mark Slayton, who guilted me because I did not own a physical copy of sneakers in my collection. And I like sneakers, and I first initially bought it just to shut them up, and then I revisited it and went, yeah, this is still pretty good. Phil writes, I've been on a Sean Connery Bond kick. Well, again, you'll hear some more of this a little later in the show. Mark writes, Terminator Dark Fate. The quiet parts are really wonderful. Samuel writes, Return of the Jedi. I don't know. I just needed some cute Ewok floofness mixed with family drama. Daniel writes, Rosemary's Baby, Miss Switch, Hocus Pocus, From Russia with Love, The Others, Framed, Don't Look Now, Dick, Live Flesh, and Kika. Joe writes, Raw Deal, Joe Shearer, Bad Therapy, Halloween 3, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, Shocker, Police Academy 4, Citizens on Patrol, The Jack in the Box, 18 The Party, and Sea Fever. Cassandra writes, Hocus Pocus, Nightmare Before Christmas, and we're working on Season 2 of The Crown. And did I mention Abominable last week? Cassandra, you might have. I read a lot of titles. It was on the cusp of when you normally ask for movies, so I forget if I included it or not. It happens. It happens. I have to open up two Facebook pages, so read last people who submitted late last week and this. These are my problems. Don writes, Death Trap. Olivia writes, Pirates of the Caribbean. Denise writes, That Thing You Do, Pan's Labyrinth and Jojo Rabbit. Thomas writes, does The Queen's Gambit on Netflix count? Sure. You watched it. Jamie writes, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, Hocus Pocus, Book of Life, Coco, and Infinity War. Kristen writes, Gretel and Hansel, very pretty and kind of strange, Urang, which together doesn't necessarily make a great movie. How? Beverly writes, Beetlejuice. Tiffany also chimes in, I also watched Beetlejuice this week. Melissa writes, The Witches, Halloween 4, Halloween H2O, Halloween, the 2018 version, and Silent Hill. Tony writes, Satsi, Crash, and wrote The Inferior Haggis, not Cronenberg. Yes, got it. And I believe Chris Lloyd watched David Cronenberg's Crash, so there's that. Frank Watch says, watched Alita Battle Angel. 'Twas pretty good. Frank, I saw that on my flight to Scotland last year, and I also liked it. It's another expensive B-movie sort of from Robert Rodriguez. And you have Mahershala Ali and Christoph Waltz in the same picture. Charity writes, Rebecca and The Lie, and she really enjoyed the new Rebecca. Gary writes, A View to a Kill and The Living Daylights. Just a Bond kick. Non-Connery Bond kick. Taylor writes, Dangerous Mission and The Danish Girl. Lou writes, The Last Day on Mars, Buffaloed, and X-Men Dark Phoenix. Jonathan writes, The Offense, a very different film with Sean Connery. It was if a cop film had been written by Edward Albee. Jonathan, I like that. I also watched The Offense, and I'm going to talk about that a little later on. I think I might have to steal that line from you. I'm sorry, borrow that line from you. Carrie writes, Envy. Nick Rogers writes, Hollow Man, Hocus Pocus, The Dark Half, The Doorman, Outland, Sean Connery and basically High Noon in Space, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Totally Under Control, Trial of Chicago 7, and The Addams Family. Vicky writes, Swallow, and said it was strange but good. Yes. John writes, Halloween 6, The Producer's Cut. I just read about that, John. Love to hear your thoughts on that. Jed writes, I watched Peter Lorre's Face Behind the Mask. Great film, highly recommended. I also checked out a film you posted a photo of from Zardoz. So thank you, Matthew, for making my week more entertaining. R.I.P. Sean Connery. And I'll leave you with The Gun is Good. and we know what's evil. Brian writes, Bone Tomahawk. Cassie writes, The Bat. Ben writes, Star Trek Insurrection. Steven writes, Judgment at Nuremberg and A Place in the Sun. I hope that wasn't a double feature, my friend. Jeff writes the Iron Sheik documentary called The Sheik. That's a good one. Bob writes, Let Him Go. Robert writes, The Shining. Terry writes, Black Christmas, Theater of Blood, The Killers, 1964, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1978, Town Bloody Hall, oh, I need to see that as well, and Bad Timing. Speaking of Trapped in the House, Andrew writes, Misery. David writes, White Tiger, a Russian film about a ghost tank with subtitles and subtext. Thank you, David. Larry writes, Easy Money, the Rodney Dangerfield film? Wow. Teresa writes, Pretty Women, Hidden Figures, and she writes, drumroll please, Mannequin 2. Takes all kinds. Grace writes, watched Hocus Pocus on Halloween. I'm now thinking very seriously about getting a cat. All right. Brent. Brent writes the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy in one day, no less. Brent, it's still ending. Judith writes, I don't know if I can write. Okay. That's just a statement, I think, more than just a title. Okay. Steve writes, it's the 5th of November and has a V for Vendetta image. There you go. Joe writes, Free State of Jones, Hocus Pocus, and Practical Magic. Linda writes, The New Rebecca, great, and the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, darling. Cheryl writes, Host on Shudder and Poltergeist on Halloween. And finally, Rachel writes, I Sell the Dead and the Woman in Black. So there you go. Hope you were able to jot down some titles. Hope you are visiting films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as checking out old favorites to get us through these twisted times, especially because it's getting cooler. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, friends, it's epic guest chat time. Simon Majumdar, you know him from Food Network. He has written some fun books about food. He also has a fun podcast called Eat My Globe. Season 5 is available now. We're about episode 5 of this year. But he's been on the show before. I swear I'm going to have him on when a major artist doesn't die. But we talk about Sean Connery as well as Jeffrey Palmer and a lot of stuff. So strap it in, folks. Here's it's not quite Lawrence of Arabia long, but it's Frank Zappa album long and fun. Here's my epic chat with Simon Majumdar. Enjoy. Simon, congratulations on season 5 of Eat My Globe. When did the research for this season begin?
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, so we did a very short season 4 that we actually recorded at the beginning of the lockdown. That got cut short a little bit just because I was traveling before, trying to cram some things before lockdown. So I kind of dived into season 5 research probably at the turn of the year. Each episode, I would say each season, if it's usual, about 10 episodes, is going to be almost the equivalent of writing a book. You know, we're looking at kind of 10 episodes of about 8,000 words if you were just to read them. So, yeah, that's a lot, particularly when it's on lots of different subjects. So, you know, it usually takes me about 3 or 4 months to kind of put them together, and then they have to go through a process. They go to, you know, my wife looks at them, and she looks at them from a kind of editorial point of view in terms of the research, make sure my citations are kind of approach, the right thing. Then they go to UCLA and they read them. And then from UCLA, they come back to us and then we go and record them. So it's a long process. I'm in the middle, actually, right now. I'm about halfway through writing season 6. And we're looking to kind of record that at the beginning of the new year. So maybe February, if I'm having to push it back a little later. So I try this season, we'll finish about December. And then we'll take a little break, and then we'll start recording again. So we're trying to do 2 good long seasons a year, which is probably about all I can fit in.
How have the productions, as far as recording them, have you had to adjust it still under the current conditions?
Well, I've done a couple of interviews that I've done from home. It's a little difficult in a slightly noisy neighborhood in Los Angeles. But, you know, I did one where I was kind of hiding under a blanket that I did recently with the producer of a host of a show on YouTube called Tasting History, which was rather good. And I came across it and thought that it was so good that I wanted to find out more about what he was doing. So we did that a couple of weeks ago, and it got a very good response. Actually, we've just been up to record some more. One of the things that I think is kind of, I don't say fortunate, because there's nothing fortunate about the lockdown, but our producer, April, her husband is a virologist and a surgeon and have a house very close to here in Ventura. And so he's being checked and the family are being checked kind of constantly in terms of safety. And they have a studio in the hospital, so you're probably not going to have a safer place to have a studio where you get checked when you go in and everything is kind of safe, and so we can literally dip in, record, kind of clean off the studio as you do there, and then come out again. So we actually went up there to do some interviews for the new season in the new year, because it was the only time some people could do them. So that was great. And so hopefully we'll be able to get up there in the new year, depending on, you know, lockdowns and things again, and record the rest of it in February, assuming it's been able to go through the process. But we're going to keep doing it. We've created a Patreon page so people can come and, you know, support us and sponsor us, which people have done in a surprising number, which is terrific.
Yeah, well, it's like opening up the saxophone case if you're a musician.
Well, that's exactly what we've said. I mean, this has always been a labor of love for me. We've done 5 seasons. We've never asked for sponsorship. It was really just a way of me trying to share my passion for food history with the world. But, you know, there are small costs involved in it. We're certainly not going to try and do this for profit, but there are things like, you know, travel details and all of those kind of things that we had to do. You know, we went out to see Ken Burns last year on the East Coast, and we're all on the West Coast. So, you know, those things cost money. And so if we can have people who recognize what we're doing and want to support us, you know, and no one has to, we're never going to charge for it. But if they want to, then it's lovely that they do. And actually, it's been terrific that people have. And every little bit will kind of help.
Yep. I mean, and especially now, because anytime we can get any form of content, because I know that I think I'm only one of 2 people who are actually in the recording or in the radio studio. Everybody else is doing it from their home studios. So the fact that we were still able to create stuff in these times, it's kind of reassuring for the listener.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things that we find is that, you know, people are constantly kind of coming to us and saying, you know, oh, when's the new season, which is great. Sometimes I have to explain to them that it's not, you know, like a podcast where you're sitting and chatting with someone over something. And there's not, I mean, that's not a criticism of those. I listen to a lot of them.
Thank you.
It's not necessarily a lot of research necessarily to all of those, or if there is, it's something about something current, so it's pretty easy in terms of going to papers and things. When you're doing something that's kind of historical, you're going to have to go to all kinds of different libraries, and so there's just a longer process to it. And I said, it's not a kind of, well, saying one's better than the other, it's just the time it takes can often be a little longer, so I have to explain to people that I'm not just sitting down and kind of making it up as I go along. It needs to be kind of factually accurate and all of that. And so sometimes I think that could be a little harder. People are asking for the new season. I tell you what's very interesting right now is, you know, as momentum builds and people are coming back and going, oh, I like this show, and we promote it a lot, obviously, on Twitter and Instagram and all the rest, as you should do, because we put so much effort into it. A lot of people are discovering it. So what we've noticed is going all the way back now, over 2 years now, we're getting really good kind of listens every week in the kind of high hundreds every week to the new to the old episodes, going all the way back to the history of fish and chips, which was the very first episode.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. So I think what I hope anyway is, you know, for as long as we keep doing it and we have no plans to stop, we'll create something that's really useful of content, and in, you know, however many years, people will look at it and go, well, that was useful. And that's kind of all you can do, I think.
Absolutely. I caught up with the season so far this week, and listening to it, I guess I'm asking from a podcaster to another, do you outline or do you write out your script?
So I write, I work in different ways. There are some scripts that kind of come together pretty easily in terms of the kind of key points I want to touch on. I do a lot of research beforehand, but also I find as I'm writing, I will go and dip into an area and try and put that in there as well. So, the show can go pretty straightforward from A to B. There are some where I start writing and I kind of, you know, find myself going down really interesting rabbit holes. And then suddenly I go, oh, well, I'm going to go off in this direction. So, for example, I'm just writing just before I was speaking to you, and I'm going to finish now for the weekend or until Sunday. I might take a break. But I'm writing on the history of military rations. And, you know, that's really interesting because you go from ancient Mesopotamia, you go through Alexander the Great, you go through the Romans, you go through, obviously, the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, as they used to call them. And it kind of all stops a bit there for a while in Europe because, you know, people weren't that sophisticated. But then you go over to China, and I hadn't been thinking about it, but I was like, oh, China and Mongolia. And suddenly I find this huge slew of information and the art of war and all of those things over there. And I'm like, I need to be writing about that. So I'm now having to rework my kind of essay. And then, you know, the hardest thing I think for me is not to write it as a lecture, but to write it as if, you know, it's me, and hopefully I achieve it, and you can tell me because you listen to it more than I do, it's me chatting to people. So I want it to be very accessible, because one of the things I find with a lot of history podcasts, which are wonderful, they're really well put together, but often if they're put together by a professor or they're very accurate, but they can sometimes be a little dry.
Yes.
And what I like to do is to go, I'm kind of one of you. I'm not an academic historian by any manner of means, but I'm a kind of what I call a gentleman enthusiast. I love doing it, and I find it really interesting, you know. I remember last time we talked, I think it was when Terry Jones died, you know, Terry Jones came from that kind of boarding school background where you have the teachers who are gentlemen enthusiasts. And before that, they did a show called Ripping Yarns, which were all about these kind of gentlemen, British gentlemen who went off around the world, kind of did stuff. And I've always thought of myself in that kind of camp where I just go, oh, I'm interested in that. Let me go and look at that. And the joy, I think, of doing it is that, quite frankly, it's my podcast, so I can do what I like. And if people don't want to listen, then that's also fine. You know, so, someone said to me once on Twitter about, you know, the service to your listeners and blah, blah, blah. And I go, well, in the end, I go, unless you want to pay me some money to do it, I said, I'm going to do what I want because it's mine. And I don't mean to be rude, but, you know, it's kind of that's how it's going to be. But anyway, I hope people, if they do listen, for everyone listening, eatmyglobe.com. You know, we're going to keep doing it. We've over 50 episodes now. We've covered a lot of really interesting subjects. The new season that I'm working on right now, we've got the history of olive oil. As I said, the history of military rations, the history of the chili peppers and hot sauce, all of which are, you know, really the history of brandy. All really fascinating stuff, because we kind of think of them as kind of everyday things in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you go, but, you know, let's think about the chili pepper, which went off all around the world, you know, has a real connection with the African-American community in America, particularly people who came over as part of enslavement from Portugal and West Africa, and brought the peppers that were planted there by the Portuguese and brought them here, and they became part of their identity over here. And there's that whole saying of kind of having hot sauce in my bag that Beyonce sang about, and it's part of an identity, having hot sauce.
Yep.
And you go, well, that's a chili pepper that started when Columbus kind of bumped into someone in, you know, the Dominican Republic or Haiti. So it's just this fantastic history, and that's why I love doing it, because it just takes me down a whole journey. If I could find a way of doing it kind of much more without having to go off and earn cold hard cash, I'd do a lot more of it because it is really joyous for me to do.
Oh, absolutely. Going back to what you were saying earlier, listening to it is not academic, so I don't feel like, to use Python, that I need to put my coat on the peg and write a letter home and get my hair cut. And when you said service, I was like, please don't say you service yourself. Please don't do that. Please, please, please. So I'm glad you didn't say that. That's good. And actually, since you told me you were doing some work inside a hospital, would you consider the history of hospital food?
Well, I've been looking at doing something on that. And in fact, I was thinking for season 7, which is even thinking further ahead, because I don't want to do too much on kind of rationing because it will overlap. But, you know, going to look at people like Florence Nightingale, who worked in, you know, the Crimean War. And, you know, she obviously changed all the hospitals before that. They tended to be either, you know, in the Middle Ages, run through convents and places like that. And, you know, the kind of death rates were rather high. And I've thought about kind of the food that they would serve there. And she was one of the first to bring in actual cooks. There was actually a very famous chef in London called Albert Soyer, who was one of the great first celebrity chefs, who wore this flashing red beret everywhere that he went. And he went to cook for her in Scutari and for the troops because they wanted really good food. He took people out there. And unfortunately, he picked up a disease and it kind of did him in. But again, you find these, what I like to do is find these great little bits of history. And one of the things I found out is she was, of course, Florence Nightingale. So, you know, that became the Nightingale became that connection with kind of healing. And one of the things was that all her nurses, who were these young women who came out from kind of middle class and upper class families to help out, they were called the birds. And it was that was the connection why Liverpudlians called, you know, women nurses girls birds in the 60s. And it came from Florence Nightingale. So again, just these fascinating little kind of nuggets of history that you find out of nowhere. And the one that I'm writing about in Rations that I mentioned, I think I put it on Twitter, where the Mongolians would be riding, you know, kind of without saddles on their horses and for days on end, and they wouldn't carry anything with them apart from their weapons. And the only way they would survive is they would put a tiny micro nick into the neck of the horse and suck blood from it as they were riding, so they never even had to get off the horseback. And they would take all that would be their fuel. So just these kind of things that you find and you go, wow. And that's hopefully what people get out of it. They go, oh, that was really interesting. They may never do anything with the bits of information that I give them, but hopefully it just gives people a wider kind of a view of the world and certainly what they eat. That's what I hope anyway.
Absolutely. You mentioned earlier, later in the season is the history of hot sauce. And I think that's one of those items that people use as a part of their culinary identity, like their beer, their spirits, and definitely either their brand or their pepper as kind of what they what is their go-to for everyday dishes.
I definitely think so. I mean, you know, and obviously you've got pepper sauces coming in from Asia. You've got pepper sauces obviously coming in from Central and South America, you know, particularly down to Mexico, the home of, you know, chili peppers. And then obviously you've got pepper sauces in places like West Africa. You've got peri-peri. A lot of that was taken over there by the Portuguese. So you can take something like a chili pepper that you think of as a pretty everyday now. You know, it's not hard to find a hot sauce or a chili pepper in any supermarket. But when you look at what it did in terms of how it went around the world and how much it was grown and how it was taken to India, completely changed the cuisine of India. And I've been talking about that in my latest episode on the history of curry. I think it's just really fascinating. And if you look at it now, so, you know, when we were taking some photographs, we kind of put our masks on one day and we did a kind of car-only journey and drove out and stood in front of the Sriracha factory. And people don't often think about Sriracha. They think of it as an Asian pepper sauce, but actually it's made in L.A. And it was made by an Asian immigrant into L.A., but it's always been made in L.A. And people think of it as a Thai sauce or a Vietnamese sauce or something else. And the origins of the people were from there, but it's very much an American-made sauce. So again, that's just a great history that people go, really? It's, you know, it's made in LA. So, you know, it's, but people use that definitely as an expression, or Frank's hot sauce, obviously, or, you know, what you use in Buffalo hot sauce, or, you know, all of the different ones that you have. And now, of course, there's a big culture of hot sauces, and there are places you can go to that sell thousands of them. And they range from kind of being very mild to the kind of ghost pepper end of it, which I'd never quite understand. But you know, it's become it's very much its own culture.
So you're not the endorphin rush kind of guy when it comes to eat. You just want to eat?
Nah, it's like I don't get it. I don't get it. But.
That's all right. Me neither. I can't remember the show, but there's a show where they interview a person. They will interview a known person, and you know, they have a chicken wing, and which each wing the sauce gets hotter and hotter. There's some familiar faces on there. It sounds like something you wouldn't do. I know I wouldn't.
No, I wouldn't do it in a heart because I don't get it. Food, you know, food can sometimes be adventurous and sometimes challenging, but it shouldn't be an endurance.
There you go. So season 5 of Eat My Globe is available online as well as eatmyglobe.com. Simon, can you tell the folks what episodes are already posted when they go to the website and the podcast?
Yeah, so if you go to the website now, you'll have the first 4 seasons are complete, which was about 40-something episodes. So far this season we've had the history of curry, which has just come out, the history of cookbooks, the history of caviar. So we've had some really interesting ones, hopefully, this year. Last season, we had the history of champagne, the history of garlic. Previous episodes could be things. We've got the history of lobster, the history of truffles. We've got the last meal served on the Titanic. We've got a history of beer. We've got history of trying to think now, so many going back to the history of fish and chips, as I mentioned, you know. So we keep going. As long as there's ideas, we'll keep going. We've got a history of pasta, which is a really interesting one because it helps decry that silly myth that Marco Polo brought it back from China. Yeah, we do a lot of that kind of myth busting in there without trying to be kind of mean to each other, people about it. But there's a lot of that still goes on that people tell you that, you know, people in the East Coast rioted when they were fed too much lobster when they were in prison, which is just kind of bunkum, as I call it, in complete bunkum. But it was there are actually reasons why it's there, and they usually come from a magazine story at a much later date when they were trying to exemplify some aspect of a society. So it's all really interesting, and I tell all those stories. And then later this season, we have 5 things you didn't know came from L.A., and then if people like that idea of doing a city, then we'll go, you know, when we can, we'll go to some other cities, maybe New Orleans, maybe Chicago, maybe New York, and we'll write about some of the things that people go, oh, I didn't know that, you know, I didn't know that's where it came from. Sriracha is a perfect example.
I was about ready to ask that, so we should never forget the history of gin. And,
of course, yeah.
Actually, in the curry one, part one, I was curious if you could maybe do a brief version, because when you say the word curry, it's not only a specific dish, but it's also a specific style, a specific genre. Can you clarify that a little bit?
Yes. So, I mean, the word curry is still used in India now, but it's almost come back to India from Britain, and they use it as an overall for a kind of protein, a spicy protein dish that's in a gravy, in a thicker sauce. And really the way I look at it is if the equivalent I use is American Italian food. So if you look at authentic regional Italian food, it's very different from what you might get in an Italian-American restaurant or an American-Italian restaurant. But both can be delicious. So what happened was the British went over to India, you know, particularly kind of tail end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, fell in love with the cuisine. But they tended to move around India a lot, took their cooks with them, you know, and they created this kind of almost like a caste of Indian dishes or Indian style dishes that became known as curry dishes. And the term curry comes from Tamil, which means to blacken or to charcoal, and it's just connected to the dish that way. And they became known as curry dishes. And when they moved back to England at the end of their stints in India as bureaucrats, and then after India became independent, they began to open restaurants serving this in the UK. And then, you know, Indian people, particularly people from Bangladesh, came over and took all over those restaurants. So the way I look at it is Indian food, authentic Indian food, I'm not always a big fan of that word authentic because it's very hard to define, but food from the different Indian regions, and British curry food, which is mostly what you might see here in the United States, are two very different things. And they can both be absolutely delicious. But they're kind of, one is very much the kind of uncle of the other, as it were. One kind of helped the other one grow. And so I think they both deserve their own recognition. And that's what I was trying to do. Now, the next episode that is coming out on Monday is really fascinating because of the British influence around the world when it had an empire. It's about how curry spread around the world. So, you know, you will find curry dishes in South Africa. You will find curry dishes in, obviously, Jamaican goat curry. You will find them all over the world. And I'm not going to give away the story, but it's how it got there from Britain.
That is next week with season five of Eat My Globe. And my daughter, we have an Indian restaurant where we live, fortunately. And chicken tikka masala is my daughter's dish. Vindaloo is my dish. And my wife, she's open. She tries anything. So is also, go ahead.
No, so you saw with those two dishes, you actually get a perfect example of how fluid this whole thing can be with Indian food. So vindaloo actually has, as I said in the suit, actually has its origins in Portugal, and it was the Portuguese mm-hmm. who brought that over, a pork dish kept in vinegar, vindaloo. It was vinegar and garlic, and that's what it means, vindaloo, and it comes from viandalos, the Portuguese for pork in vinegar and garlic, and they brought it over to India, and they brought over chili peppers at the same time, and so the Indians began to cook it with palm vinegar and chilies, and so it became a Goan dish. And then at the other end of it, you have chicken tikka masala, which is actually created in Britain. And whenever you see an Indian restaurant with chicken tikka masala, what they're really cooking then at that point, you know they're cooking British curry-style food, because that dish was created in Glasgow. And the gentleman's passed away now, but I actually met the man and went up to the restaurant to meet him, the man who invented it.
Oh.
Kind of sent it off around the world, and it was created in Glasgow in the kind of early mid 70s. So it's not really, it's got a relation to dishes in India, and it falls under that curry because it's a protein in a spicy gravy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very much a kind of a British Indian dish.
Wow. And it's funny, when we get takeout, we can always find mine first because mine's always dark red.
Oh, yeah. Well, and a lot of that can be, traditionally it would be because they used what was called it's a style of chili called a Kashmiri chili, again, brought over, grown in India after chilies have been brought over. And that makes everything very red. It's what makes tandoori red. Unfortunately now, and I can't speak for the restaurant you're using, but they tend to use a little bit of food coloring because that's a lot cheaper than buying these
right.
beautiful Kashmiri chilies, which you can actually find in perfectly safe. I mean, it's safe food coloring and stuff. But if you go to an Asian store and you go and look at their dried chilies, you'll see Kashmiri chilies. You might even find Kashmiri chili powder. So if you do try and make these kind of curries at home, go and buy some from your Asian store. And they're not very strong in terms of heat at all, but they give the most beautiful color. And I have both dried and pre-ground in my house of those because I use them a lot.
Well, I will have to ask my friends over at Gulzar's, unsolicited plug, see what happens over there. The other thing I love about this place, Gulzar's, is, and I'm sure you have them in your neighborhood, it's an Indian restaurant, but it occupies the building that used to be a Mexican restaurant.
Well, that's actually, again, speaks very much to how Indian restaurants really began to kind of grow in popularity in England. You know, after the Second World War, particularly, there'd been a lot of bombing in England, and a lot of the old fish and chip shops and those kind of things had been bombed out. And the people who run those had tended to move out to the suburbs. They either made a living or they'd retired. And so a lot of these buildings were kind of a little dilapidated. They were near pubs. And these Bangladeshi, particularly people from what's now Bangladesh, was then East Bengal, came to stay there. And I talk about this in the episode. They came to stay, and they took over these spaces and created Indian restaurants. And and they were very popular, and they became absolutely kind of at the heart of British kind of eating out, because they were really near the pubs, and they would stay open after people came out of the pubs. So if they wanted a few more drinks, they'd go and have a curry and they'd get a couple more pints, which is a very British thing. But the notion of them taking over previous restaurants and, you know, the people who run these restaurants, and they may well be from Bangladesh. They nowadays people from different regions of what was the whole Indian kind of subcontinent. Taking over, you know, coming in, and if there are restaurants available in a good space, mm-hmm. they'll take the opportunity to run them, and they do a great job. I mean, you know, I tend to cook a lot of Indian food at home, so I don't buy a lot of it from outside, just because that's what I cook.
Sure.
But when I do try them, you know, people are working very hard to do something that's really delicious, so I'm never, you know, disappointed.
Growing up here, you could see a number of old Taco Bell places that are now used car lot offices, and old Pizza Huts that are like insurance or medical facilities, because you recognize the structure of the, because they were all built the same back in 1975.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting how things kind of develop as you move along through history, and we see buildings. And one of the things I always find fascinating, which is sometimes I'll go to a kind of, in London, you can go to the British Library or some old district offices, and you can choose a building in the center of London. And you can, there's one I did that's actually a pub. It's called the Jerusalem Tavern. Now, obviously, it's a new building, but this was the Jerusalem Tavern, and it's where Crusaders stopped in like the 11th and 12th century at a tavern on that spot, on their way to the Crusades. And what's again fascinating is there's still a pub on that spot. You follow it all the way through, and I think for 90% of its existence, it's been a pub. And you're talking about nearly 1,000 years. So going through and seeing who owned it and how it got changed and what kind of, because you'll see little notes about there was a riot outside in 13 something because there was, you know, not enough corn or whatever. And you can see the history of a country just by looking at the history of one building. And you can see that in the United States. In fact, Sybil and myself, or my wife, that is, we went to, I'm trying to remember exactly where it was now because I was in the car and I was kind of, we went to the very first McDonald's, which is just outside of Los Angeles. And it's not now, it's a little museum. But you go there and it's the classic old building with the arches that they kept, and, you know, they've tried to keep it as close to the original as possible. And you look at those buildings and you think how that almost described America for a certain period of time, those golden arches.
Yep.
And you know, the history of that, you know, I have one friend who I've lost touch with a little bit, but his family owned a scrap metal business, a big prosperous scrap metal business out in Evansville, Indiana, and they made from their scrap, they supplied all of the materials to make those golden arches, and it's kind of how they ended up doing very, very well.
Oh, wow.
So you look at the history of it just from the golden arches, and it, you know, it tells you a huge amount about the American industry.
Mm-hmm. This is Simon Majumdar here on Film Sociology. Season 5 of Eat My Globe is available at eatmyglobe.com. I know you. One of the episodes you did this season was about Roman feast. Is that right?
Well, we looked at the whole of the Roman Empire.
That's right.
And I always say we, because there's so many people involved, the people at the Department of History at UCLA, my wife and our producer. And so although kind of in that sense I'm the face because I present it, I always like to say we made it. But yeah, so we looked at the whole of the Roman Empire. We looked at the slaves. We looked at, you know, gladiators. We looked at the Roman army. We looked at how the rich would live, how the poor would eat at the first kind of takeout restaurants. You know, so it was really interesting to look at how the Romans existed because, again, the way they thought about food was just very different from us. But and I know we're recording this, and I'm not certainly not going to start talk politics now, but the notion of bread and circuses.
Yes.
And so, you know, that came from that Roman period. And it is one of those things that, you know, as long as people aren't too far away from their next meal and they've got something to entertain them on television or at the movies, you know,
mm-hmm.
obviously that's what you talk about, you know, people tend to be, you can keep people pretty placated. And what's interesting is that you can see that going all the way back to, you know, ancient Rome. So I think that's fascinating as well.
Well, I bring that up to ask you, for research, did you watch the film Caligula?
I have seen Caligula. And,
but not for this.
What's really interesting is there are versions of Caligula that cut out all of the, let's say, the
Guccione portions?
Pleasantness. And what I think is rather interesting is that there are potentials within there of that having been an interesting film. It was just that Guccione came in and inserted, one uses the word hesitatingly, but inserted slivers of untowardness, shall we say,
yes.
while in the middle of the film. And I remember, I think it was Peter O'Toole or one of those people who was in it, kind of going to see it at the thing and suddenly realizing what they'd been in after filming it. It's a fascinating story. I think there's a book on it, the whole making of it.
There is.
And it is one of those stories a bit like when you hear the making of Heaven's Gate or you read about the making of Wizard of Oz, which that obviously was a great success. But the making of some of these films that you watch in history, and then when you end up watching the film and you're going, really? All of that darkness and all of that stuff that went on, and we end up with this on screen. I don't kind of get it.
I believe it was Malcolm McDowell who told the story of, you know, he thought he did a couple decent monologues in that film, and then halfway through his speech they cut to, how should I put it, inaction.
Yeah.
And then cut away back to him. But yeah, that's the other one I thought of when it comes to food and cinema, well, actually in this case drink and cinema, was you mentioned Gladiator. I'm like, ooh, I think Oliver Reed could have survived the Roman Empire.
I think Oliver Reed would have destroyed the Roman Empire. He was a remarkable, I mean, Oliver Reed, of that ilk of the time, obviously you had Richard Harris, Peter O'Toole, Oliver Reed, and Richard Burton. And there are classic stories of the four of them going out.
The book Hellraisers.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine published that book in the UK and, you know, and made it available in the United States. And they were legendary. And I still remember actually being at the Savoy, very young, in the early 80s. I was at university. And I'd taken a girl there, and I wanted to buy her a cocktail. And I didn't know anything about what I was supposed to be doing, and it was going to cost me more than I ever should have possibly spent on a drink. And I'm sitting down, and we're about to order, and suddenly a glass of champagne appeared in front of us and then in front of kind of all the other people who were in the bar. It wasn't terribly busy at the time. And they'd been bought for everyone by Richard Harris because he was staying in one of the apartments upstairs, and he'd come down and got drinks, and he'd fallen off the wagon and sort of decided to buy everyone who was in there a drink to celebrate. So while I was in there, I got a glass of champagne. Not that I got to see him, but apparently I got a glass of champagne paid for by Richard Harris. So
that's not bad. That's not bad. For those folks, the book is called Hellraisers, The Life in Inebriated Times of Richard Burton, Richard Harris, Oliver Reed, and Peter O'Toole. And that's a favorite book on this show. And I always tell people it's a combination of Hollywood stories and Hollywood Babylon. So I preface it by saying, think about your worst night of drinking, and it was brunch for these four.
Oh, I mean, you know, these were. I also remember my favorite Richard Harris stories. Again, it was at the Savoy, apparently. And he'd been in the bar, fallen off the wagon. He'd gone in there in his dressing gown. And, you know, they all kind of were used to him, and he'd got very drunk. And they were carrying him out almost kind of horizontally up to the elevator to take him up to his nice suite. And he was looking very worse for wear. And a group of Japanese businessmen came in as they saw him being carried out horizontally. And he looked at them and shouted at the top of his voice, "It was the shrimp." He just kind of carried him to the elevator. I think whether these things are apocryphal or not. But you kind of hope that they're not, because you know, these characters, funnily enough, were so amazing. And funnily enough, I put something on Twitter the other day where I was talking about Richard Burton. I'd been watching The Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
Yes.
I hadn't seen it forever, and you know, I hadn't seen a Richard Burton film for a long time. And first of all, he was at the height of his inebriation at that point. I mean, he was drinking probably more than a fifth of whiskey a day. And they were, and yet, whenever he came on stage or the set, there was no one else. It didn't matter. It could have been 20 people. It could have been one person. It was as if no one else existed on the screen. And I said that I'd forgotten just how incandescent he was. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really was extraordinary. And that, I mean, Oliver Reed perhaps slightly less so in terms of that kind of level of acting, although, you know, he came from a great acting family. But Richard Burton, I mean, Peter O'Toole, these people, yeah. Richard Harris, they were incredible. And I don't know. I'm glad we don't have people, as many that I am aware of, who kind of are that level of kind of self-destruction. But at the same time, I'm not sure that we have many people who are at that level of talent at the moment, who literally just, it's them the moment they walk on screen. And I'd be hard-pressed to name any. I mean, there's some at a kind of less kind of grand level, like Mark Rylance, who I think is probably, I think, the most extraordinary actor mm-hmm. in film right now, just as a pure actor. But I don't think they're not living at that kind of extreme level.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not seeing Rylance toss bottles at a full pub or anything like that. Yeah. Well,
he's just extraordinary, and I think people in America are beginning to recognize his talent with things like, I think it's Bridge of Spies, and then obviously more recently with Trial of the Chicago 7.
Yep. I remember, two things. One, it was, I think, Harris near the end of his life where he said he had stopped drinking, but he was still drinking Guinness. And people would call him out on it, and he goes, really, does that count? But the other one was Oliver Reed's last night on Earth. He had finished Gladiator and apparently, you know, drank a bar under the table and were arm wrestling sailors a third of his age.
Oh, he was just an extraordinary man. A kind of, you think of the kind of Falstaff, you know, kind of character from life, and that's what he was. He just decided to live his life at that incredible, incredible level. Interesting enough, with, you know, you talk about Guinness, though, my mother, when she was carrying me, which is probably explains a lot, but when she was pregnant with me, she was, you know, iron deficient. And so she actually got in England in the early 60s when I, you know, she was pregnant with me. She got a prescription that she could go into any pub and get 2 half pints of Guinness a day. And it was the proper parian, and she would, yeah, and they would, it was 1 pint she could get, but because she was a lady, they wouldn't ever serve a woman, particularly in those days, they wouldn't serve a woman in a pint glass, that wasn't seemly. So she would get 2 halves of Guinness, and she always used to tell me that she would have one, and if they had like a menu or something on the table, she would hide the other one behind that so people couldn't see both pints, both half pints. But, you know, that was, she got it every day.
Well, and look how you turned out.
My last post on Instagram yesterday was a pint of Guinness. So there you go. So again, it's just interesting times to look back.
You mentioned The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, which I need to revisit. I think a lot of people remember the kind of Babylon stories and especially the later years of Burton and. But you're right, where one, when he's on his game, I mean, he was kind of untouchable. And it was also that particular film is one of the best, you know, anti-Bond films of that era.
Well, it's so quiet.
Yep.
Is an interesting way. It's lots of conversations. And the writing is, you know, I mean, obviously coming from Jean Le Carré, and it's got that beautiful kind of writing to it. That you find, even if you're watching the more modern version, which I loved, of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, or if you listen to his books, we did a long drive fairly recently, we were listening to one of his books on audiobook. It's got that flow, But yes, the fact that it's so, it demands a lot, particularly of a modern audience who's used to seeing kind of shots and explosions, and particularly in a spy kind of movie. But this has none of that. It ha- you know, a little bit here and there, but it has mostly conversations, and they're brilliant conversations. You know, when he's being interviewed, or the kind of conversations in the when he's working in that library at the very beginning, mm-hmm. some private library, and it's just these very slow conversations, or the conversations between Richard Burton and Control, and they're so kind of a style because it's Britain not long after the Second World War. But they're really fascinating, and it's obviously Britain beginning to emerge from kind of the slumbers of post-war rationing, and you just see it. I was absolutely taken away. My breath was taken away by watching it, and I hadn't seen it in, you know, probably 15 years. And I just thought it was magnificent. It was certainly one of the best things I've seen recently, which is a shame because I've also ended up watching some, you know, new films.
Well, we're going to get to that in a second, but there was one other. You had an episode devoted to caviar, and as I was writing my notes, I always remember the fight that George Lazenby has in on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and after beating the guy up, basically just shoves a cracker into some caviar and mutters that it's beluga and just leaves the hotel room after a fight.
Well, I mean, the caviar, obviously, again, and I talk about it as a history, and there's just great history around something like caviar. And we obviously think it, and there you go, James Bond, and you think of it in a great hotel, and you think of them, you know, having his cracker and his beluga, and it's like, oh, is it the good or is it the bad? But there was a point in the 19th century in America where caviar was so plentiful, because they used to catch it all up in Albany area. It was so plentiful, they'd give it away in sandwiches in bars because it was so salty. And the people who came from Albany were known as sturgeonites because they had so much sturgeon up there from which they got the caviar. And it was known as, I think, Sturgeonville, Albany's nickname was, which has obviously all gone because it was all fished out. But you think of something that we think of now as so exquisite and so rare and so, you know, something that you would only treat yourself to if you were, you know, particularly special occasion. And you go back 100 years or so, and people would be giving it away in pubs.
Gosh, lucky, I guess. So so you mentioned you've been watching stuff at home, Simon. What films have you been watching recently besides Spy Who Came In From the Cold?
Well, there's a lot of... I've been very disappointed with some because I've been catching up with some like reboots or reworkings of some franchises because, quite frankly, and again, I don't think this is even a political statement to anybody, with all the stuff going on with politics, a lot of the times I don't want to watch anything terribly serious. And particularly if I've done a whole day researching and writing for an article or something, for a, you know, an episode. So I started watching things like... the new Men in Black film, or whatever it was called.
International?
International. And it was just dreadful. And then I watched, I thought, oh, right. So, yeah, I kind of dragged my way through that. And then ended up watching the kind of reboot of Charlie's Angels, which was, if you could take Men in Black and you could take Charlie's Angels and make them completely dull to the point where I want to fall asleep. And this, I'm a man who... you know, grew up in at the age of my teen years. I think we're probably pretty close to the same age, watching Farrah Fawcett or mm-hmm. whoever, you know. Charlie's Angels, let's say, yeah, probably had a special place in my younger teenage years.
Yeah, ditto.
And to watch it where you go, it was like almost like watching paint dry. And so I found those things rather kind of depressing. I was much more impressed by, maybe I'm a Sorkin fan, but the Trial of the Chicago 7. I thought those are the kind of films that I really enjoy. The kind of, like, just like I enjoyed All the President's Men, and I would put into that kind of things like, what was the rather good one set in the Boston Globe where the
Spotlight.
Spotlight. And those are the films where you really get into depth. You've got an ensemble, and you can tell that they are having a great time doing what they do, the kind of acting, kind of battling with each other. And it was a great cast. And I think that's certainly the best of what I've been watching. The other thing that I've been watching is I started watching, well, I did watch The Big Night.
I love Big Night so much.
And again, it's one of those that I was saying to my wife, oh, I haven't seen that in ages. And it was on whichever, I think it was on Canopy, which is a great resource for people who want to watch movies that haven't been around for a while. And it's free. You get X number. You join through your local library. It's Canopy with a K.
Mm-hmm.
And they had it on. And I said, right, I'm going to go and watch a Big Night. And it is just fantastic. I mean, A, it's great acting and you've got, you know, terrific cast, but it's also that you've got great food. And if you're at all interested in kind of really beautiful looking Italian food while they're talking and drinking wine, then it is not to be missed. And I certainly think it's going to be in my top five of, you know, kind of food films ever.
Absolutely.
I would imagine.
Yep.
And the other thing that they had, again, as I've been trawling around, and one of the things I find is that, you know, Netflix is great with some new stuff, and they've obviously had some new films. Amazon, Hulu has a few that I think we talked about one last time that still remains my film of the year, Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yes, yep.
Still my film of the year. But one of the things I find is things like Amazon in their kind of darker recesses of Amazon Prime, because they don't have as much money to be creating big films, they go out and buy a lot of depth of some things.
Mm-hmm.
So they tend to change quite quickly, but I watched Charles Laughton in A Private Lives of King Henry.
Mm.
I watched, they only had it, it kind of disappeared, but they had A Matter of Life and Death, and I'm a huge fan of Powell and Pressburger. So I went to watch that. I'm actually taking the opportunity to go back and try and rediscover some of these films that I haven't seen for, you know, decades in some cases. The Red Shoes was on, and that, I think that was on Canopy. And I watched that, and that was really worth seeing. You know, again, Powell and Pressburger at their almost best. I think they were doing a season because they also had Peeping Tom on there and Life and Death of Colonel Blimp.
Mm-hmm.
I think Peeping Tom is Powell and Pressburger. But these are great films of that period, of the kind of just post-war period in Britain. And they're just beautifully made. And then every now and again, I'll sit down and watch something that I love that lasts forever, like a long film like Lawrence of Arabia or something. But I'm finding some of the kind of modern things that are coming on, I think it's maybe because they're holding them until they can really put them into the cinema first. They're not, nothing's really desperately exciting. I can't think of anything this year, apart from maybe Portrait of a Lady on Fire, that has really made me go, wow. And I don't, maybe that's just unfair, or maybe I'm just in a kind of odd mood when I'm watching TV and I just want to flop out. But I'm not desperately excited by anything right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I just directed a play in October, and I'm supposed to be in a show in December, but I still haven't stepped in a movie theater. I think if there was, I've talked to a few other critics, and if there was a private screening just for us, I would feel a little more comfortable. But stuff has been sent to me through certain studios, mostly smaller ones. And, you know, seeing it on your computer is one thing, seeing it in your living room is another, but it's not like the communal experience. And that's still, I'm still not ready for that yet.
And I absolutely understand it. And I get this both from, when I'm trying to work and we have to go into studios to film, and luckily for me, people like the Food Network work at a very high level of excellence. And if you do go into the bubble, everything is done to make people safe. So that, I kind of have a lot of confidence in that. But I've had people say to me, well, you should be going out and supporting restaurants. And I go, you know, I'm not comfortable. And mm-hmm. if I'm not comfortable to go into a restaurant right now, I'm not going to. And yes, I want to support restaurants. They're my friends, and I love them, and we do take out as much as we can. And you know, but I said there's a big difference between that and me going to sit in a restaurant, and I understand how that they'll be careful. My problem is everybody else.
Yep.
I know that the restaurants that I will go to will be very, very careful, but I don't know that everyone who sets foot in them. And here's the thing, whatever people think of kind of COVID, I mean, people are dying. And for the sake of going to see, you know, Mulan at the cinema or eat a dinner somewhere, I can wait.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can wait. Yes, it's depressing. And yes, I'd love to be going out to restaurants. And yes, I would love to go and see a great movie. But right now, I'm fine.
Good. Speaking of which, how are things, how is the current situation with you and Food Network?
Well, we've got, you know, when they're filming, obviously Food Network are planning to do and are doing a lot of things kind of in the bubble, as they say, where you go in and you get tested. And then we've also done some things at home. So you may have seen there was an episode of Guy's Grocery Game.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very clever. So they did a kind of home delivery. So they sent me boxes of food. They sent a kind of minimal crew, all of whom had been tested like a gazillion times. And they came into their house and I got tested and all of those things. And we filmed. And it was the first time I'd cooked on Guy's Grocery Games. And, you know, I won't give anything away in case people haven't seen it, but it was fun. And so those kind of things are great. But there's a limited amount you can do. It's the same with some of my talks. But then I do a lot of talks, a lot of cooking demos. So what I've been doing is with videos of my cooking demos and then sending those, and I do a Zoom alongside them. And that's a way of, you know, kind of doing what I do normally. And for example, coming up in the next week, I'm actually doing a scotch tasting for somebody. And so I've bought three different types of scotch. And this is for people who kind of like scotch but don't actually know, because it's, you know, it is a complex subject to talk about. And because it's so varied and how all the age statements and how all of this works is pretty interesting. And so we're actually going to try two or three scotches and then a kind of single malt from around the world. And I think I've got one from India.
Oh,
he's making some really interesting single malts now.
Very good.
So I'm trying to kind of, like everyone, make as much as I can from home to keep earning income. You know, like anybody else, I've got to pay my bills. And I also, quite frankly, I from when we've tried to speak before, I'm traveling all the time. So when I'm more stuck at home, it's harder for me. And that's where, you know, kind of coming back to the podcast, that's where I managed to be kind of easier to kind of keep myself occupied, because I can sit down for 3-4 hours and start writing, and I feel a lot better about things because I get lost in it.
Mm-hmm. One more Food Network question, and then we're going to get back to movies. Have you checked in with Alton Brown this week? Go ahead.
Alton's a good pal, he's having fun.
I know. As I read it, and by the way, go to Alton Brown's Twitter page, especially in election. It was like if Patty Chayefsky wrote Network for Twitter.
In many ways, you know, we all try to kind of express the craziness of the situation we're in, and it's all exacerbated because of COVID and because of how we had to get out and do these things. And so nothing was normal, and nothing is normal right now. And he's just, for me, and I've said this before, he's the smartest guy I've ever met. And just being able to swap a few texts and chat with him while he's having fun is always great.
His Twitter feed was very Zappa-esque that evening. So,
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I just that's a great thing, because I only discovered yesterday that there is a new Zappa documentary coming out, and I'm very happy about that. It's a major one.
Yep, I'm looking forward to that as well.
Yeah, and Zappa has been a kind of stalwart of my life, and I've been listening to him since I was probably far too young to be listening to Zappa.
Do you have a favorite style of Zappa? I mean, he's kind of like Bowie when it comes to music identity.
Well, he went to all kinds of different places. He, you know, he, when I listened to some of the early stuff and then some of the 60s, like Freak Out, I really enjoyed the very muso kind of middle bits with Overnight Sensation. I love Hot Rats. But then I even liked the 1970s stuff that he did in like Shake Your Booty. And even I must be one of the few people in the whole world who listened to Thing Fish the whole way through.
Oh, I have Thing Fish. You Are What You Is.
Yeah. That's the album you put on to scare people away when you need them to leave the house.
It's the Last Call album.
Yes.
Even his orchestrated stuff. I mean, or something where he would do guitar. It would just be, you know, 68 minutes of guitar solos strung together.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, all of those. I've got all of that, the album, the triple albums of guitar solos. And I am a completist.
Oh, yes. So. Good challenge there with his. I think it's Dweezil that has the keys to the basement. So fingers crossed that stuff keeps trickling out. Shifting gears a little bit, I saw an older film, and by the way, Simon is my unofficial British film historian. You know, congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you ever see the film Mr. Topaz?
No. Which one? Remind me what Mr. Topaz is.
The lone directorial effort of one Peter Sellers.
Wow. No, I never did see that.
It's on Film Movement Classics. I want to say it's. I think it was 2 years before The Pink Panther. But he stars in it as a school teacher who's having a thing with the headmaster's daughter. He gets in trouble and winds up taking a job as a PR guy for a corrupt politician played by Herbert Lom. And
oh, wow.
It's one of those understated Peter Sellers performances, which, of course, in the United States, we never saw until pretty much being there or even Strangelove. But no, it's a really nice understated performance and film from him. But yeah, his only time directing. I don't know why.
He was one of those, particularly his kind of his early funny ones, as it were, the British movies in the 50s, 60s. I mean, he was extraordinary, but a very damaged
yep.
character in many ways. And I remember seeing him once on, there was a very great chat show called Parkinson, which was like,
yeah.
Big, and they had everybody on there. They'd have Fred Astaire and they'd have, you know, David Niven and they'd have, you know, all these people. And he was always extraordinary on there. And when he switched on and he was funny and he was bright and he was, you know, intelligent. And then the moment the camera went off, it was the host would always say it would just be like he was a piece of glass. There was nothing. And it was just they could never figure it out. And they think, you know, if they look at it now, he was just very damaged by things that had happened earlier in his life. And, you know, it's a great if you go and look at the chat show was he was called Michael Parkinson. And they're all on mm-hmm. YouTube. And there are amazing interviews with Peter Ustinov, David Niven, like I said, Fred Astaire, you know, everyone of that period. Bacall was on. I mean, and it's them. So it ran from kind of the late 60s through to kind of the late 80s. So it caught all the end of probably all of those people, John Wayne, you know, mm-hmm. all of those. And they were real proper questions. It's not just someone coming on advertising their latest book. It was they were just there. And they would fly, you know, the days when they would fly them over from the US to the UK to be interviewed. And
yep.
If you get a chance to go on there and listen to, you know, there's one where they have Itzhak Perlman playing, playing his violin. And at the same time, Larry Adler was on. So they played together and played Summertime or something. I mean, it's just magnificent. If anyone has a chance, all on YouTube.
Very good. Of course, I want to wrap up the show today by paying tribute to two guys who definitely got their money's worth when it came to work and life. I want to start with Simon. What was your first memory of Sean Connery?
Well, I think like a lot of people, it probably was watching Sean Connery in Bond. And I think they are. I mean, it's really interesting because people go, "He was the best Bond," and it's a glib answer. But in terms of creating that kind of suave style of kind of British spy that everyone thinks of now. You know, the whole, even something like Johnny English is based on kind of, you know, that whole kind of spoof on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's impossible to say that he wasn't the man who created it. Unfortunately for me, I find the Bond films now are kind of a little bit too much of their time in particular ways.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of people will know that, particularly with Me Too and all that. I find them a little bit troubling to watch. And that's not his performance. It's just what they are. It's like reading a kind of watching an old TV show from the 60s and 70s and going, oh, dear,
yep.
You wouldn't get away with that. And I think so. I think there's a struggle with that if you do watch it. And I think the shame is by going to that kind of glib thing about Bond, which I did when I, quite frankly, on Twitter, I said he was obviously the best Bond. And so I'm guilty of it as well. We forget that he was capable, obviously, of so much other amazing performances, you know, and obviously people look at the Untouchables and they look at, for me, Robin and Marion, or
yes.
The Man Who Would Be King, or you know, even Zardoz, I mean, the kind of crazy stuff. But I think, you know, the thing is about his movies is that he was always Sean Connery. And so if you look at some of the other actors that we mentioned, Mark Rylance earlier, who kind of just goes into the kind of spirit of whoever he's been playing and kind of just changes.
Yeah.
Philip Seymour Hoffman had it as well. A few of them. Sean Connery just said, I'm going to turn up and be Sean Connery. And it doesn't matter whether he was supposed to be an Irish cop or he was supposed to be a sci-fi, whatever.
Or, yeah, the Wind and the Lion, or everyone's favorite Russian submarine commander, or yeah. Or Highlander.
Highlander, exactly. He's just, but that's what you wanted.
Yep.
That's what you wanted. And you want, if you had Sean Connery not being Sean Connery, then you kind of felt slightly jilted. So I think he's, in that sense, he was bigger than the movies. And there, I'm not sure that there are people like that, again, now, who are so, just such big stars that you want them to be who they are. Otherwise, you're going to feel, and I think that goes back to old Hollywood. You wanted Bogart to be Bogart in every movie.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted Mickey Rooney to be Mickey Rooney, or you wanted, you know, whoever you wanted them to be. And you're going to see a movie with X because of X. And I'm not certain that we have that kind of star power quite anymore of that. And I'm trying to think when we perhaps last did. Maybe you might go back to kind of Eddie Murphy in his early movies. Where mm-hmm. you go, it's a new Eddie Murphy movie, I'm going to see X. Or maybe Arnie, when he was doing, you know, Total Recall, and he was at that kind of megastar stage of his career, where you went, it's a new Arnie movie, I'm going to go and see it. I'm not sure that we have anyone at that level now. Maybe Will Smith, when he did Independence Day, and a few others around there.
Mm-hmm.
But and they were pretty much who they always were, and you went to see them as that person. And that was Sean Connery, I think, is kind of one of the greatest of those.
Yeah, when he passed, I over the last week, I kind of binge on a bunch of his films. In fact, I concentrated solely on non-Bond stuff. So I'm going to throw some titles at you that I've watched, and I'd like to know if you had seen it or what your thoughts are on it. Are you ready?
Let's go.
All right. First one I started with. First off, the fun fact I love about Connery was he worked with Sidney Lumet 5 times.
I did not know that.
Yes. And we're going to get to a couple of those. Of course, the ones I didn't talk, he was in Murder on the Orient Express, of course.
Yeah.
He was in one of my favorite films involving cinematic gene pools, Family Business, where he is he's the eldest of there's 3 generations of thieves. Sean Connery is the oldest. His son is Dustin Hoffman. His grandson is Matthew Broderick.
Gosh, I have not seen that.
I want to see what the women look like in this household. let's see. There was that. There was. So the first one I watched was The Offense.
Oh, yes.
1973, where he is it's based on a play of a grizzled British detective who after 20 plus years of grisly cases, finally snaps while interrogating a prisoner. And it was one of those, it didn't do well when it came out, but it was Connery's attempt to do something where he's seen as vulnerable. And he's obviously tough as nails in the beginning, and as it goes on, he slowly starts to lose his bearings. And it was funny you mentioned, yeah, people want to see Sean Connery, and this is a really good performance from him that hopefully more people will check out.
I'll definitely need to go and look that up again. It's been a long time since I saw it.
On YouTube, and I guess I don't know if it's official or not, but I brought it up anyway, but there is a 1961 broadcast where he played Macbeth.
Oh, my gosh, I have certainly not seen that.
With Zoe Caldwell as Lady Macbeth. So the music...
He had the accent for it.
Yeah, yes, and it's good. I mean, it's good. It's not John Wayne reciting To Be or Not To Be. It's a little more than that. I think my favorite non-Bond Connery film, and you had mentioned it, would be The Man Who Would Be King.
Which I absolutely love, because I think it kind of brought together at almost the kind of height of their powers, you know, two of the greatest British actors of the last kind of 40, 50 years, you know, Michael Caine and Sean Connery, and kind of summed up that period of British filmmaking. Because despite the fact it's kind of set in a kind of Victorian period, it's a very modern film, and they're just so good in it together.
Yep, and you also have John Huston directing. So I remember the late Gene Siskel talked about if two actors having lunch is more interesting than the film they make, I would love to have seen a dinner with those three on top of the film itself.
Would have been amazing.
Yeah. And it's funny because Huston had been trying to make that for years. He originally wanted Clark Gable and Humphrey Bogart in those roles.
Well, that is definitely going back some time before.
Yep. A lot of fun. Another film I really enjoyed, and I hadn't watched it in years and years, The Name of the Rose.
Which is, I had read, when I saw that, I had only recently finished reading the book, the Umberto Eco novel, and enjoyed that a lot. And the film, by its nature, because the book is, you know, you could build a house out of three of them because it's so thick, that I kind of, obviously, they'd wiped out a lot. And I was also very disappointed because I thought, and Christian Slater?
Yep.
Yeah, was not terribly good in it. But he was the hot young thing at the time.
He was.
How long ago it was made. It was like in the
86. Yeah, he had done a couple things. But it was one of those, I think it was a hard sell for the mall crowd if you're saying it's a murder mystery set in a 14th century monastery.
Yeah. But the book is well worth reading.
Yep. And he gets some scenes with F. Murray Abraham, which is always, that's some nice acting tennis.
Yeah, they get to chew the furniture together.
Yeah, quite well. 1964 Hitchcock film Marnie.
Oh, of course. Yeah, wonderful film.
Yep. And
it's a long time since I've seen that.
It's funny. You could watch this on a double bill with Spellbound because it's like a Hitchcock melodrama as far as the relationship between, I mean, and Connery gets to be the cool, and just basically not James Bond, but and not a spy, but he's cool and collective. And Tippi Hedren does a lot of the heavy acting lifting with her character. But, you know, that's not a bad job to work on when you're not doing a spy thing. The other Sidney Lumet film that he did and I really, really liked is The Hill.
Oh, my gosh, yes, yes. You're reminding me of some things that I haven't seen for many, many years. Yes, The Hill.
Yep.
Now I'm going to have to go and look all of these up again.
There you go. Yeah, Harry Andrews, Ossie Davis, and just another kind of psychological battle of will and physical battle of wills. And really, really well done. I did watch Robin and Marian, which is my second favorite Robin Hood film after Errol Flynn.
Which is terrific. It's very well done.
Yep.
The thing I always think about now, of course, is that you find out that, I mean, it's kind of a well-known story now that he was the original choice to play Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings and turned it down just because he just didn't want to do it and just spent all that time in New Zealand. But half of me kind of, much as I think it was, you know, it was a splendid performance anyway, but half of me just wants to know what he would have been like as Gandalf, because I'm sure he would have been fantastic. It would have been a bit like his appearance as King Richard in the other Robin Hood.
The very end, yeah. And we mentioned earlier of action films, and I think I have to do research on this, but I think some people call Connery the original action geezer because I believe he was 66 when he did Entrapment with Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Oh, yes.
So,
gosh.
Fun chemistry between those two. I just think of Catherine Zeta-Jones and lasers for some reason.
Well, I think that became the iconic thing, and it's been spoofed in so many films since then.
Yep.
There are certain scenes from certain films, and that definitely spoofing that, and I can think of about two or three. You know, oddly enough, when you watch some of these spoof films, actually they're the ones that I began to enjoy. I watched Smoking Gun, Naked Gun, mm-hmm. the first one for a while, and of course it's so ridiculous and so funny that I laughed all the way through it.
Wow.
And it's just kind of silly, and I think that Entrapment definitely was one that had just one of those scenes that got copied by everyone.
Yep. I asked Mrs. Soucy, and she still says no, so I keep trying. you mentioned this film. It is actually a line from the film as a part of the end of this show. I unabashedly love the bonkers film that is Zardoz.
Well, it is bonkers, and I think sometimes it's nice to do something in your life that is completely bonkers, and you just go, look, here we are, this is what we're doing. And one of the things I will say about him is he completely goes for it.
Yep.
You know, and that's, if you do it and you're kind of half-hearted, it's going to flop anyway. But the fact that he just does it.
Yep.
It's on Hulu right now, I believe, and it's I watched some of it. I've got to finish the rest of it because I got distracted by something else. But I'm definitely going to go and finish watching it.
Yeah, the fact that John Borman took all of his Deliverance goodwill and pushed all of his chips to the table and said, I want to make this, and I want Sean Connery to look like this, and, you know, a warrior enslaved by a peaceful commune, and you also have Charlotte Rampling, which isn't bad. But, yeah, I mean, this is a pure 70s film if there ever was one.
Absolutely. In a way, when you come into the late 70s, early 80s, was it Borman who also made Excalibur?
Yeah.
And so, he was a man who was not afraid to put himself out there, because Excalibur is another completely bonkers film.
Yes, it is. And I think that was my introduction to Helen Mirren, that and Caligula. So that explains a little.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Another one that I forgot I had this and hadn't watched it in a while. Do you remember the 1966 comedy A Fine Madness?
No, I do not.
Irvin Kershner, who would later direct Empire Strikes Back, and would later direct him in Never Say Never Again. But it's set in New York. He's a poet with writer's block, and he winds up his wife winds up paying for a psychiatrist for him to check out. His wife is tough. If you're Sean Connery, your wife is Joanne Woodward, and you fall for the wife of a psychiatrist played by Gene Seberg, and Patrick O'Neill is the shrink.
Oh, I think he would have been just fine.
Yeah, he was the as you were mentioning earlier, something that doesn't age well. Near the end of the film, Joanne Woodward asked him to take a shot at her, and he does. And you immediately think of, and it's a comedy, and so you immediately think of the Playboy interview and the Barbara Walters double down, and you're like,
that's never acceptable, and it's one of those things that you go, I don't care what point in the century you were born, there are some things that A, are just wrong, and that's wrong, and B, why would you even say that, even if you were stupid enough to think it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, it will haunt, you know, his memory, but so it should, because it was just, you know, just a lousy thing to say and to even think about. It does kind of throw a shadow over Sean Connery for me. It must do. I think it must do to anybody who, you know, has any sense of decency.
And I think it's the... you know, I think we're of a certain age and a certain generation. We're separating art and artists is a little easier. I think also being white guys is a little easier. You know, as much as I enjoy his work, I don't think I could timeshare a condo. When he was still here. So that's just kind of where that is. Shifting gears, got a couple more titles. As I was jotting down notes on this, I thought of this as The Man Who Would Be King Light. But if you remember The Great Train Robbery.
Oh, yes, of course.
With Donald Sutherland and Leslie Ann Down and Michael Crichton, one of the few non-science fiction novels, stories by Crichton. But a bunch of actors having a good time, and you get two stories, basically, the accumulation of the keys and then the heist itself. And then finally, I broke one rule. I actually revisited Never Say Never Again, which is the one non-broccoli version. And as I'm watching it, because this came out, I believe, 4 months after Octopussy.
Yes, it did. There was a big thing. I remember being, you know, a student in the UK, and people were talking about it and which will be the best. And I just remember his wig being rather unfortunate, and that was kind of. I saw both films.
As did I.
It's the only time I've ever seen Never Say Never, and I never need to never say never again.
Well, the scenes where he's forced to go to a fitness farm, you know, acknowledges the age a little bit, and Barbara Carrera gets to chew some scenery, which is nice. Apparently, he was three years younger than Moore when Moore was doing Octopussy. So, but yeah, the hair is a different story. The other note I had, and I thought of you. I think because it's Sean and nobody else involved with the history of the franchise, is this the Bond version of the Clash album Cut the Crap?
Which is an awful album. I saw the Clash. I saw the Clash doing. You know, I saw them in many stages, but I saw them in that rather last stage, and it was like watching a death rattle.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
So, well, there you go. So salute to Sean Connery. Thank you for your work. The other one we just found out about at the time of this recording is, at least I put him in this, is kind of Hall of Fame that guy. But Jeffrey Palmer, who, 93, I believe, got his money's worth.
Yeah, he really did. And I think, you know, when you try and explain him to a lot of people, they might not know him, but he was, as you said, he was in everything in England. If you particularly wanted someone to play an army person, or as most Americans might know him, as being the doctor in one of the great Fawlty Towers episodes of Dead Body. He always played the slightly stuffy father, but who had, you know, a good kind of turn of phrase. You saw him in Fish Called Wanda. He had that very dour British kind of upper middle class to upper class look. He's kind of, I always think that most people in life have a natural kind of military rank. Just by looking at them, you know what they would be. And he was a brigadier. That's what he was.
Nice.
He was a brigadier. And, you know, I think I would be a quartermaster if I ever came to me. But he was very definitely a brigadier. And when you saw him, often you would see him in a kind of brigadier's outfit.
Yep.
He was very kind of upright, and but I think that kind of look, that stereotype of him, did him a disservice. He was capable of great humor, very dry humor, as in things, sitcoms like Butterfly, which is one from the 70s, and As Time Goes By, which is one of the more well-known ones, perhaps in the United States, where he worked with Judi Dench. And they were great friends, and they knew each other. I mean, that season went on for about 9 years. So, he's one of those kind of, he's always there. So the fact that he was 93 and probably hadn't acted in a little while surprises me, because he's one of those you think is part of the furniture, the acting furniture, particularly of Great Britain.
Yep.
But when you go back and look at his work, you'll see that he's, you know, contributed an enormous amount.
Well, and I went to IMDb and printed out the got 13 pages of his resume. And yeah, he was, I mean, credits go all the way back to the 50s. And of course, in the UK, work is work. You do movies, you do plays, yeah. You do television, and that's all there is. There is no social structure as far as, you know, if you do movies, your career is over. If you go from movies to television or vice versa. I was going back trying to figure out the earliest thing I had seen him in, and now it means I have to go and find it. But I forgot that he was in Oh Lucky Man.
Oh, yes.
And yes, in stuff like Beyond the Limit and Clockwise. And, yeah, you mentioned A Fish Called Wanda because I think that was my first incarnation of, oh, I know that guy. He was, of course, in The Madness of King George, Mrs. Brown, Admiral Roebuck in Tomorrow Never Dies. You mentioned that. Paddington was his last finished credit back in 2014. Apparently he did something that's in post-production, but you mentioned it earlier. So I knew him as from those titles, Madness King George and others of, yeah, that kind of stuffy gruff, authority figure here at the station here at WFYI. When I first moved here back in 99, and they did this for years. So during the school year, they would show from 11 to midnight. They'd show two episodes of Are You Being Served? So my wife and my wife and I know every single episode. We've probably seen every episode like four times. The summer break from that show was As Time Goes By.
Okay.
And that's what we watched. And you know, I think that was my first time seeing Jeffrey Palmer do comedy. I shouldn't say serious comedy because I've mentioned Clockwise, but it was something more than the image that I knew him from. And it was fun with my wife to watch those two. And that's another example of verbal tennis, of just really nice lobs and volleys with each other.
Well, if you get chance, you should go and look up a very quiet Carla Lane comedy called Butterflies.
Yeah, that's it.
With a lady called Wendy Craig, who I think is still with us. But he plays the husband. She never has an affair, but potentially is. They've got two kind of lazy sons, one of whom is one who ended up in the most famous British sitcom of all, Only Fools and Horses, and Nicholas Lyndhurst. But there, in this, he's about 16 when he's acting in this, and it's fantastically well done. And he plays the quiet father who sits there and is constantly traveling. And it's the classic British businessman of the 1970s. And so he's very kind of suit and tie and there, kind of hippie-ish, but not quite, and driving him nuts. And but the writing is very gentle, very gentle, very beautifully done. And it's a sitcom that kind of got into the skin of the British a lot because it is that it's very British, and very quiet, and very well worth watching.
Is it double British?
It is very double British.
Nice. Well, Simon, plug your stuff, plug your social media and the podcast and everything, because this has been a lot of fun, and we could go longer, but then it would be as long as Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes, and I don't fancy riding in on a camel from a distance.
No.
So if people want to find me at Simon Majumdar, will find me on everything. You'll find me on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and I'm everywhere you would expect someone to be found. And you'll also find at Eat My Globe on the different channels. You'll find all the latest episodes at eatmyglobe.com if you want to go and listen to some really fun stuff about the history of food. Do go and listen. We love, love, love hearing from people, and just going and chatting about food, but also, as you can tell, like chatting about films too.
I think we went as long as a Zappa album, so.
I think so. Probably like one part of a triple.
Nice.
But it's always fun to chat. And now it's your perfect timing because I'm getting my wife looking at me saying, why aren't you cooking the bulgogi that's been marinating? I've got that. No words need to be spoken. I've just got that look that says, why are you still talking when you could be cooking for me?
In my household, I call that sitcom wife look.
Yes, it's very definite. You need to have a wah, wah.
And even
as you do it.
In my house, even though the show's named after the husband who wins all the Emmys. All right, Simon, I really appreciate your time. And yeah, I raise a glass to you. I appreciate your help.
Always good to talk to you. Enjoy watching your movies.
You too. Take care.
Take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Yes, Zardoz will always be a part of Film Sociology. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Hope you're staying safe. Hope you're staying healthy. Hope you're staying sane. Hope you're being good to one another. Keep digging for old movies. Look for movies that are new or new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Check out Simon on Food Network and check out Eat My Globe, the podcast. And we'll try again next week. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!